just have to learn to share it.
She said she was really concerned.
So, first item would be item 17.01.
Madam Chair.
This is disciplinary proceedings concerning AOC case number ED-2015-0003. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to remand item 17.01 to the administrative law judge for further proceedings and instruct the administrative law judge to hold a hearing on the merits of the case.
Thank you. Proper motion. Is there a second?
I second. Well, everybody's
second. I think we should call the vote, please.
Board Member Durham.
Yes.
Board Member Flores.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Masnak.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
Yes.
Board Member Rinkin.
Yes.
And Board Member Schroeder.
Yes. Next item, I hope, is 13.01.
Yes.
Oh, there she is. Okay. Commissioner, let me turn this over to you, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to invite Melissa Kolsman and Carol Gates up to the table. This is our standards review and revision process update, and we've been continually giving you all sort of how we're going to go about this and seeking your feedback on the process. And so with this, I'm going to turn it over to Melissa Kolsman and Carol Gates.
Good afternoon, and thank you. So for our agenda item today, I'll introduce myself. My name is Melissa Kolsman. I oversee the Division of Student Learning. And joining me today is Carol Gates, who oversees our Standards and Instructional Support Office. Our purpose today is to provide an update on the standards review and revision process for you. You should have some materials as part of your packet. One is a copy of the presentation. You should also have a copy of the kind of the overview proposal for the standards review and revision process. In November, we looked at a couple of pieces of this. Our intention is to bring forward different components of this to you over the next few months for your feedback and for your guidance. You should also have a copy of the results of our standards perception survey. And I believe you may also have a copy of the actual survey tool itself. So those will be referenced throughout our presentation today. Our purpose for you, for our time together today, is first of all to orient state board members to the standards review and revision plan. We haven't been to before the board since November on this, and we also have and welcome a new board member today. We will also provide an update on our stakeholder engagement that we've been working through these last few months. First of all is the standards perception survey. We'll be able to go through some of the results of that. We'll also be able to talk a little bit about the online standards review system and how the participation on that has been and the type of information that we're able to gain from that. And finally, we would like to solicit your feedback on the upcoming committee application process. So we'll start with an overview of the standards review and revision process. At this point, if there's the best document to reference at this point would be the proposal for the Colorado Academic Standards Review and Revision Plan that you have as part of your materials. We'll be looking to the State Board to guide each stage of the standards review and revision process, and are pleased to continue that today. So, just as a grounding and orientation, the rationale for this really comes from Senate Bill 212, which passed in 2008, Colorado's Achievement Plan for Kids, CAP for K. It requires a regular review of the Colorado academic standards, and that is to occur every 6 years, with the first review occurring on or before July 1, 2018. Just as a quick reminder, this is not related to our ESSA state plan development process. This is a completely state-driven process. at our November meeting, we had an opportunity to go over the guiding principles for the standards review and revision process. You'll find those both on the slide and on the first page of the proposal for the review plan. The guiding principles that we have proposed are that the process be transparent, that the department make every effort to ensure that the decisions for the processes for the review and the revision are public, that it be inclusive, that we would strive to engage key stakeholders in each phase of the review and revision process, and there would be opportunity for substantial and frequent opportunities for the public to weigh in, that it be research-informed, that throughout the process, we would base any recommendations we bring before you or our committees, that they be based on research, lessons learned from other states, and objective third-party reviews, that the process be consistent with statutory requirements, that it be substantive, that it focus on the substance of the actual standards themselves, and that they be improvement-oriented. On page 18, you don't necessarily have to turn there if you want to at this moment. I will just let you know that one of the questions that we asked during our standards perception survey was related to these guiding principles. And I'll just give you a sneak peek. It's actually slide 18 and page 18 of your report on the survey outcomes. The respondents, 90% of the respondents to our survey believe that it was extremely important or very important to incorporate educators' input to the revision process. We believe that relates to the principle about this being an inclusive process. 84% believe that it was extremely or very important that the process be open and transparent. That goes with guiding principle on transparency. 78% believe that it's extremely or very important that the review focus on the content of the standards themselves, which goes to the idea that the process be focused on substance. 76% believe that it's extremely or very important to have diverse representation on the committees, which goes to an inclusive process. 66% believe that it's extremely or very important to improve on the existing Colorado academic standards rather than start from scratch. And that goes to the notion of improvement-oriented. An interesting point was that 35% believe that it was extremely or very important to incorporate public opinion into the revision process. As with any survey, when we look through those, we always need to kind of unpack those a bit and try to understand them to the best of our ability. But I wanted you to be aware of the public feedback on these guiding principles that we've brought forward for you.
Madam Chair, could you describe the sort of demographic, or not demographically, but from an interest group purpose, exactly who responded to the survey?
Absolutely. We'll get into this a little bit more, but I'll preview that right here. Of the respondents, we had 65% of our respondents were educators in the K-12 system, so those would be administrators, teachers, district administrators. 10% were parents. 7% were educators at an institution for higher education. 5% were students currently enrolled in high school. All of the other demographics were anywhere 3% and below. From our specifically, we had.
Could you repeat that, just those top groups, please?
Yes. Top at 65% educators. Next at 10% parents. Next at 7% institutions of higher education. And 5% students. All of the other constituency groups were less than 5%. And just to give you a sense, I think you asked specifically about education policy advocates.
Yes.
There were a total of 17 respondents out of close to 3,000 that were education policy advocates.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So what we'll do right now is, both for the benefit of time, since we've been before the board, as well as for the benefit of our new state board member, we're going to spend just a couple minutes looking over some of the big picture process issues. I'm going to hand this off now to my colleague, Carol Gates.
Thank you. So I'm going to just share the next three slides, which are a quick review of the review and revision draft plan. We presented these at our November meeting. This slide will illustrate the key roles and responsibilities for this review and revision process. At the center of the process is the State Board, as you are the decision makers for the process and you have the authority to adopt any proposed revisions. The role of stakeholders, which would be situated at the 12 o'clock placement of the diagram, is to provide feedback on the standards, proposed revisions, and the review process itself. The role of the review committees, which would be situated there on the 4 o'clock placement of the diagram, is to use stakeholder feedback to make recommendations for standards revision to the state board. And then the role of CDE staff, which would be led by the standards and instructional support team of content specialists, which is situated there at the 8 o'clock portion of the diagram, will be to act as facilitative leadership and support role to the review and revision committees. This next slide outlines the four main phases of the standards revision process itself. We're currently in the first phase, which involves gathering research and feedback through the use of surveys, online feedback systems, and benchmarking reports in all content areas. The second phase will be the formation of committees to use the research and feedback to develop initial revision recommendations. The third phase is providing the initial recommendations to the state board and stakeholders for feedback. The final phase will involve the committees using feedback to develop final recommendations to the state board for consideration. This slide is just a brief overview of a timeline for the entire process. The previous slide outlined the activities really planned for that 2016, 2017, and then 2018 by July process. Once new standards are adopted, schools and districts will then have 2 years to transition their local systems to adopt local standards that meet or exceed state standards and local curricula as required through CAP4K, with implementation of new standards expected in the 2020-21 school year.
So with that basic overview, we thought we would move into the next portion of our presentation today, which is to look at some of the key findings of our standards perception survey. Please note that we've only had these results for a short period of time, and we're still looking at and trying to understand them, especially around looking at how different groups responded on different questions. So there may be some questions that you have that we also share and cannot yet answer, but we'll be looking at some of the results to see if there are some ways that we can dig a little bit deeper. I also want to remind the board that before we began this process, we had done a scan of all 50 states to look at which states had done a standards review and revision process, and we looked specifically at states that had conducted this within the last few years and had used different stakeholder engagement processes. So one of the tools that some of these states used was this type of survey, and so that's where we determined that this could be useful. We also noticed that some other states used what we'll talk about in a little while, which is an online standards feedback system, which is very specific, which is going in on each and every standard and being able to provide direct feedback on the actual content of the standards. We thought that taken together, an overall perception survey and that online standards review system could provide us both a high-level understanding of the perceptions of the standards as well as give us that very specific fine-grained feedback. So we thought it was important to do both, and we see this as a way of kind of triangulating some of our information so that we can understand what each of those different systems are telling us. So we'll first start off with the standards perception survey, which was open from October 19th through November 13th. We had close to 3,000 responses, and responses came from all counties except three, Custer, Dolores, and Hinsdale, and respondents came from 146 of the 178 school districts. The roles of the respondents, which you'll see here is what I answered a question from Mr. Durham a few minutes ago. You'll see that the vast majority of respondents were educators, at 65%, parents at 10%, institutions of higher education at 7%, and students enrolled in elementary, middle, or high school at 5%. We were actually quite pleased to see the number of students who actually participated in this survey as well. If we look a little closer at the educators who responded to this survey, so of the 65% of educators, you can see the breakdown on slide 12 of who those educators were. 67% of those educators who responded were teachers, 8% school administrators, 7% district administrators, 7% specialized service professionals such as counselors, social workers, nurse, psychologist, speech language, pathologist, librarian, 5% district non-administrator staff, 3% school-level non-administrator staff, and 2% paraprofessionals. If we then break those down by level, and those respondents who could break down their could pinpoint one specific level, you will see that we had a pretty even split across the K-12 band and a nice portion of early childhood educators who participated in the survey.
On page 12, going back one, why does that sum on the right-hand column to more than 100%?
Because some of the, that's a very good question, some of the educators might span across. So there might be a teacher who teaches K-6. There might be some teachers who teach 6-12. So they may be counted twice.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good question. Because our teachers teach more, our teachers give more than 100%, Mr. Durham, that's why.
Exactly.
So as we start to look at their impressions of the standards, so there are questions that were related to the impressions of the standards, then there are questions related to the process for the standards development. So I shared with you a little bit about the process, which is a spoiler alert because there's another slide related to that in a moment. But we're going to delve into some of the impressions. What you'll see is that overall, about half of the survey respondents view the Colorado academic standards positively. Our education policy advocates and K-12 educators are more supportive of the CAS than other respondent groups. And this is a very interesting finding, and we'll dig into this in a moment, because K-12 teachers who have received higher levels of training and support have a more favorable opinion of the Colorado academic standards than those who do not. So we're going to look a little bit more and break down these categories and look at the individual categories of positive impression by role. What you'll be able to see in the left-hand column next to the respondent role category, you'll also be able to see the N size. So you'll get a sense of how many of that particular role responded in that question. So what you'll see here again is that 49%, the average positive, and again you'll see that the education policy advocates have a much higher positive impression than the other groups. You'll also see that, as we noted earlier, their N size was 17. You will see the N size for each of the other respondent groups. And I will apologize that because of the font size and shrink and trying to get that large enough, the N size for the general public ended up being cut off, but you have the full findings in the packet that I've provided for you. So all of the graphs that I've provided for you in this presentation are included in the actual survey results. So now if we look a little bit more at the degree of familiarity of the standards and training and support. So if you look at this graph, if you look at all of the respondents, again, there's that 49%, about an average 49% positive impression of the standards. If you look at the first third of the bars below that response category for degree of familiarity, what you'll see is that of the respondents who indicated that they were extremely or very familiar with the standard, you see that their perception was higher than the average. And you'll notice that as the familiarity decreases, so does the positive impression of the standards. We found that interesting. We also found interesting the level of support received. So by support, we define that as, for instance, coaching and ongoing professional development. And you'll see that same trend. The higher the level of support that an educator receives, the higher their impression of the standards is. The lower the level of support, the lower the level of impression of the standards. Same pattern with training.
education policy advocates, did I miss it? Did you tell us what percentage were?
Right, so
was that all within the, is it included in teachers and higher ed?
So education policy advocates, we define those as belonging to, that's their primary role. Okay. And 17 of the 3,000 respondents were education policy advocates.
So, okay, but you didn't include that when you said there were 65% was teachers.
Correct. They would not be included. They wouldn't be included in that category. Those were exclusive categories. Right. So we asked some questions about the perceived level of rigor of the standards as well. So the top bar represents all respondents. So what you'll see there is that approximately 48% of the respondents believe that the standards are high or too high. About 32% believe that they are just right. If we look at early childhood, we see that percent is similar, with a greater percent believing that they are just right. The K-2 band, you'll see that there is a greater than average perception that the standards are high versus too high. Same with grades 3 through 5. You see it's an even greater proportion of teachers who think that they are high or too high, as well as it starts to back off a bit in the middle grades and high school. In your report, you'll see that there's a similar question that we ask about whether they're grade level appropriate, because we thought that that was an important question to answer as well. And again, these are some just perceptions that teachers hold about them. This next question was one that we think our online standards feedback system is probably going to be very, very useful in understanding even more. Because this is where we ask the question, what is the perceived level of revision that you think there ought to be for these different subject areas? We actually have this broken out in two ways, and this is for all of the content areas, regardless of what subject area that they teach. When you look through your report, you will notice the end size changes on some of the questions, because there are some questions that people didn't respond to. And so you'll notice that there's some variation there. But in this question, we asked from a scale from no revision to complete revision, what degree of revision do they think the different standards ought to undergo? So what you'll see here is at the very highest, which to be honest surprised us, was our English language proficiency standards. We've actually just received approval from EDAC to dig deeper into that particular question from our teachers of English language development to get more of a sense of what's happening there, because we think that that would be very useful for us to unpack that a bit more. And then what you'll see in kind of decreasing order the level of revision that our respondents believe is appropriate. This last results slide is actually something I referred to when we talked earlier about the guiding principles, because we did ask some questions regarding the process. And so we wanted to ask our respondents a little bit about what principles they believe ought to guide this process. And you'll see those results there for your reference as well. So as I noted, these results are new for us. We've just received them. We are continuing to unpack them. We do have not just the survey results and analysis, as well as some narrative of some of those findings. We also have the actual data, so that if there are some particular questions that we have that this survey generates, we might be able to see if we can garner those answers from the results that we have. Again, a survey like this can be helpful. It's a high level view of impressions, but what we think is going to be much more useful and practical in terms of being able to apply is our online standards feedback system. At our November meeting, we showed you a few screenshots of that, which is essentially, it's an online system where any Coloradan can go online and create an account to provide feedback on the existing standards. They can go to each and every component of any grade level standards and provide feedback. We've extended the timeline or the window for this feedback because we think this is incredibly important. Our intention would be to provide all of this feedback that is gathered through this system directly to our committees so that they see exactly what what's being recommended by the field, by Coloradans. So we extended the window through February 17th. If we find that we could, that it would be valuable to keep that window open, there's nothing to prevent us from keeping it open further. The number of unique users that we have so far is 136. The reason I call them unique users is because there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the number of comments and the number of users. So there's 136 users to date. There are a total of 453 comments so far. And I'll give you a sense of the type of comments that are received. In eighth grade social studies, there was a comment left on one of the evidence outcomes that it basically just said, this evidence outcome is very vague and broad. More clarity is needed for teachers to design learning outcomes and measurements. That provides the committee an idea of like, oh, so how can we make this much more specific? What is it that is about this? The only other one that I'll share with you is one at kindergarten science. There was a recommendation to add an evidence outcome that would ensure that kindergartners could explain that the sun is an energy source for food and all living things. So the feedback that we're receiving on there is very actionable. It's not perception, it's not opinion, it's this could improve this particular standard. And just to give you a sense of the distribution of comments that we've received so far, they're across these different subject areas. What you'll see is that we have a large number of comments in social studies. One of the things that we're able to do is using de-identified information, we can, and a number that's assigned to the different respondents to the survey, we're able to see how many unique individuals have resulted in those 231 comments. So this, you know, this will give us a sense of, is this a content area that needs a lot of revision, or was this someone who is very, very helpful for us in pointing out, because they've spent a lot of time digging through the standards and have spent a lot of time providing us that feedback. So we wanted to just give you that update on some of our stakeholder engagement to date. And finally, what we wanted to do is get from you some feedback on the portion of our proposal that relates to our committee selection. As Carol noted, our intention would be to engage committees for each subject area that would take the comments that are received through the online public feedback system, as well as some of our benchmarking reports that we have commissioned that we will be sharing with you in the very near future that will provide the committees with some objective information about the quality of the standards. So our intention would be to have 13 content area committees that would include educators, parents, community members, representatives from higher education and business leaders, that we would solicit committee participation through an online application process for each of those 13 areas, that applicants would be required to demonstrate some content area expertise and a willingness to serve. And we would suggest that the applications would be considered through a blind review process. What that would mean is that as those applications come in, that the names of the applicants would be stripped from the application so that the applications could be reviewed on their merit, not based on an individual being known by a reviewer, and that we would ensure that they utilize the feedback from the stakeholders and research to inform any of their recommended revisions to the board. So we're bringing this proposal forward to you for your feedback and to guide us as we consider the design of this process.
Questions? Comments? Steve?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Ms. Holzman, you've done a good job given the limitations that that you face, but I would just caution the board, and I think in going forward, have some serious concerns about first of all, any survey that's self-selecting. Mm-hmm. You had 290 parents out of roughly 1.8 million parents in the state, all of whom were self-selected. I have a hard time imagining the average parent getting home from work and saying, you know, I have to get online and respond to this survey. Mm-hmm. My guess is that those are largely contrived and generated by interest groups or perhaps educators who want to back up their position. Further, when you get to the teachers, you have 1,845 teachers and educators who responded. My quick math says that's something less than 5% of all the teachers in the state, which, once again, you face the problem that they're self-selecting, and I think any researcher will tell you that when you have a self-selecting pool from which to derive conclusions, you can't derive any valid conclusions, particularly when you have 5%. Now, if you had 50%, even if they were self-selected, it would tell you something. So I think what we're faced with as a board is to whether we find some way to ensure that you actually get average people with, in terms of parents, with average viewpoints rather than those that are self-selected, probably with the encouragement of the education reform community, or will we find a way to go out and actually get some honest, independent opinion? And I think that's probably true of teachers as well, that we don't let them self-select, that if we really want to know what they think, we're going to have to find a different way to go at it. Now, I'm not convinced that there is any other way to do this, but I think I will conclude that you're going to get, in the review of these standards, a very biased result, not reflective of parents or teachers. I think if I wanted to do my great, if I had an envelope, I'd do my great Carnac imitation. I can predict the result. I think I know what the result is. And I don't think I personally agree with that result. So the question is whether this board will find a way to represent parents and those who perhaps have a significantly different view of these standards, or whether we will allow the professionals in their best judgment to self-select and feed us some answers that they would like to have. And I think that's the problem that we're going to be facing when we do this standards review. We can't forget that we still have, for all intents and purposes, Common Core standards. They are questioned by a large number of people, and my guess is in this self-selecting group you're not going to get that appropriate questioning of those standards. So I think I'm not criticizing your work. I think you did exactly what you were supposed to do. You did as good a job as you could under the limitations that you faced. Question is, can we remove some of those limitations and see if we can get a pool of respondents that is not self-selecting? Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah. Well, along those lines, do we have any ideas of how to do that? I mean, are there any better ways to gather that information?
So, Madam Chair, so when we looked at what other states have done, you know, we've looked at some states have conducted some kind of community meetings and having, you know, bringing in folks and asking them some feedback. That could be something that we could do. That would be something we'd need to kind of look at our budget and kind of, you know, shift some things around in order to do that. Again, there are limitations, I think, as to Mr. Durham's point. There are limitations to every way that you gather feedback in terms of who's available to come to that, who would be interested in coming to those. How do you get folks who may not sit down to do a survey, would they actually go and go to a community meeting as well. But those are some things that we can explore. I think Mr. Durham also suggested the idea of some focus groups, of being able to have focus groups of educators, which would be, again, something that would be objectively conducted and not necessarily a self-selected kind of piece, so we're also looking into that. We do recognize that there are limitations to any survey. We think that's why it's important to triangulate this with some other information, and specifically we think that online standards feedback system is helpful.
Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Ms. Mazzanick, I think unfortunately the only way to get around self-selection is to do a completely random survey, which A, can be expensive, and unfortunately, I think I could do the great Karnak Act again and predict that the vast majority of those respondents will have to say they don't know.
Right.
That if you get an honest response, you're going to get an I don't know response, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The next best is the use of focus groups, and there are firms that conduct focus groups. They are extraordinarily expensive, mm-hmm. If they're done properly, because you pay participants and you try hard to randomly select those participants, and so you have to get somebody who's willing to accept $100 to give you a few hours. So even that has its limitations, but I would suggest that a good randomly selected focus group of parents off the streets, as close as you could get to that, where the seven members of this board sat behind the glass and watched a professional conduct that focus group, would give you a much better idea of how parents and teachers who are randomly selected, and they shouldn't be paired together, they should be separate groups, really view these standards. And I have no idea whether there's the kind of budget necessary for that, but as I said, if we don't do something like that, then I'll, so over the next few days, dictate a memo and put it in a sealed envelope and give it to one of you to open when we get the final report from the groups what standards should be, and we'll see how close it's going to be.
Dr. Flores.
I'm looking at page 12, which is in, you know, where you get the statistics. And, you know, I just don't think that the responses are that different than what I thought they would be. I mean, look at elected officials, policymakers. Is that us?
That would be, yes.
So you had five people. I don't remember being in the sample, but you have 80%. You know, I wish you had included me. It probably would be to the other end, slightly not at all. But even so, that is, you know, that is not in the category of extremely very effective. And I wish, you know, you had had all of us on there. If you look at business owners, you know, they're moderately, but most of them don't think that they're effective. When you look at parents, 62% don't think they're effective. The general public, 55% of the public doesn't think it's effective. And I think that's kind of what I hear when I go out to the grocery store and people stop me about, you know, the testing, too much testing, or we don't think, or when I see teachers, you know, that's what they think. One of my biggest concerns, and I mean, I just don't think that's very positive, but one of the things that I think, and I know I marked it down here, and it has to do with, I think it's small school districts. Some of these things I agreed with, but there were questions. Too small. Well, the sample maybe was... Oh, the ESL. I mean, having the ESL, I have some ideas about that, because just given some of the people at higher education that I speak with, And they're very different on how they approach ESL. So there's just not kind of a common idea of what that should entail. And some people are still teaching things that were years ago and not really, you know, kind of up to snuff about how to get kids really to be grade level. In fact, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of ESL teachers and teachers who think that most of these ESL kids will never, you know, be at the target level to graduate. And that's kind of sad. But then I think we need to bring people to the state from other places too, and we need to even train those university people to, you know, kind of see and let them know what can be done, and maybe even some other school districts, you know, that do it, that do get kids up to grade level, and that it is possible. So my two cents.
Madam Chair. And Dr. Flores, just as a point of clarification, we did send the same survey out to all of you, so it was open. You were able to take it if you wanted. And the more specific feedback that you can do is still open, so okay. We can make sure we resend you that link. But just wanted to be sure that though we don't know the identifiers of who responded,
sure.
Everyone did receive it. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Schroeder. I think when you look at page 12, I think Dr. Flores is.
Which page 12 are you on?
It's
in the report.
Academic Standards Stakeholder Survey Analysis document. I think Dr. Flores has perhaps uncovered the most important page, which is mm-hmm. how effective are the standards in promoting higher student performance, which is really the objective. Standards, I presume, only exist for that purpose. And when you look at the breakdown of this, the people who have been driving the bus in education since 2002, which is the reform community, who are paid to believe and promote these standards, is the only group that has a majority, and they have an almost overwhelming majority in believing these standards promote outcomes.
Yeah.
The problem is they have no evidence to demonstrate that. The student outcomes have not improved materially, if at all, mm-hmm. Since the implementation of these standards. Now, when I meet with these groups, over and over they contend that we're right on the cusp of progress. And, you know, it's predicting the future, so we might be on the cusp, we might not be on the cusp. But when you start to look then down at other groups who deal with the outcomes of this, Educator at Institutions for Higher Education, which, you know, tell us that 30-some percent or more of students entering college require remediation, 46% says they're, you know, either slightly effective or not effective at all. When you look at business owners, and there's way too small a group there to draw any conclusions from, but almost by a margin of 2-1 say they're not getting a better result. Mm-hmm. But again, that's entirely too small a group. For that matter, so is the parent at 191. You don't know exactly what that means. So if we're going to have a serious analysis of a board of whether or not these are A, higher standards, and B, whether these standards have any chance of yielding a positive result for the purpose which they have at least in theory been adopted, and that theory being to improve the performance of students, then we're going to have to approach this from a dramatically different viewpoint, and not let the education policy advocates continue to drive the bus. It's not impossible that SPORD could reach the same conclusion that they've reached, but I think it requires, if we're going to reach that conclusion, a lot more evidence than they've been able to provide that what we've done in the past has worked. and or some reason to believe that continuing in this direction will work. And absent that, then I think we ought to take a serious look at changing course and taking a look at changing standards in a way that we believe could drive the result we all said we wanted, which is to improve student performance.
And I want to add one thing to that. I think it's very difficult for small districts, even medium-sized districts, to really get a curricula, you know, to formulate a curricula. I know there are great teachers out there who do a fabulous job of getting content in kind of their area and maybe do a fabulous job with a book. But I really do believe that we need textbooks. We need somebody who has really looked at what we should know, and we should be doing that instead of having these swaps over emails. Well, these are really great. This idea. I have some great lesson plans here, and there's some great lesson plans here, and you know that's not the way school districts used to do that. I remember summers with a large school district, and during summers teachers would get together and
pick the books.
Not pick the books. We would actually add to what was already there lessons for the curricula that we should be teaching, and great lessons for that area. I'm thinking of a small school district. Can they afford a curriculum and instruction person? And maybe they could. But I think we need to do more.
I think the survey actually supports exactly what you're saying, mm-hmm. in the sense that teachers who feel supported, who have had training, are much more comfortable with it. And I think it has been.
And who have textbooks, maybe.
And who have textbooks. And the textbooks have simply not, from what I've learned in a few of my districts, they haven't been available. Or right. Textbooks were purchased that were said to be even Common Core aligned or whatever, they really are not.
That's
and that
right.
has been a huge challenge. If that's the case, then it's not so much the standards, right. it's the support system.
That's right. Look at Denver, who 2 years ago said, we're not going to buy books, we're just going to buy some books and we're going to try them out. 2 years ago, and here we have a full-blown, we're actually evaluating and testing kids on what they should know, but yet the teachers don't have the tools to really teach that. So, this should have taken at least 10 years, 7 years to do.
It is going to take 10 years.
It
the
is.
The districts the states that have been engaged
long. But think
long.
About what we're doing to these kids right now who are in school, who don't have the tools, and where we have teachers, especially in math, who have not been trained, you know, in how to teach.
How does this address now what we need to do?
Well,
to move forward?
You're getting the truth here that they don't think that the standards are working.
Jay.
Well, that threw me off. Forgive me, and please feel free to say. We'll talk about that another day or whatever. I remember a couple of times over the last year it's come up at the board, it's come up in other places about what is the practicality, is there something that would allow us to take these in a cycle so that all 10 would not have to be done at the same time. If that's possible, I'm hoping at some point, even though surveyed whenever all the survey information is back, there's time to check into this whole conversation, not the process,
So what kind of conversations are we having? This one today is fascinating. What content areas? Now, we can all probably presume correctly and accurately that language arts, math, some of the maybe the major core areas are definitely where we'd want to focus on. But kind of concurrent with that conversation is, why is it appear to be, why am I picking up that it's such a worry to have people randomly responding to music, the music standards, and those are even leveled in some ways, and why would it be threatening or overbearing or unbelievable or implausible or impossible to understand someone's reaction to some of the fine arts in general, but I'm thinking of, you know, even PE or things that aren't, where is the focus, if there is one, in people's minds, no matter who's filling out that survey? And the other thought right now is that standards are not, they're not the thing that produces results. If there's confusion about, that's not how they're designed, that's not what they are. They're not made to produce results. What's made to produce results is what gets taught. The standards are like resolutions. They're like belief statements. They are aspirational. They are not the performance. They represent performance, but they are not the measure by which. You know, we have to decide whether we're talking about the aspiration or we're talking about the measurement of, or the after impact of, or the curriculum, or the books. We have a different interpretation of meanings of words. I'll say it as much as I have to. I've been saying it for about 40 years now. Standards are not the performance. Standards are what you aim to have children know and be able to do. There is no measurement attached to those standards by themselves. It's the test.
But Colorado has had these standards
since 2009, not forever. This set of standards we're operating on right now was born, adopted, come about in 2009. These standards, current standards. We had standards since 1995-ish, I think, somewhere in there. Though that is what was completely revamped and redone in 2009.
So we'll have a miracle in 2019. That's 10 years from 2009. Do you think that?
Well, there is a time span that you have to allow.
I'm just saying, this is not a brand new concept. It's not an old concept that we are examining whether or not we're going to live with standards or not. Are we going to even have standards? You know, down there at that end of the table today, are you promoting the idea that we have no standards rather than try to sit down and get some good survey information and a read on where the public is?
We've always had standards. In fact, I brought a book, 1935 that I found. That was standards then, which I would say are not too different than what we have now, than what somebody should know.
Steve?
Well, you know, go ahead.
I think...
And it was a Colorado standard.
You know, I like a free-flowing conversation, but we need to make sure everybody gets a pass.
In response to Ms. Goff, I think the answer is that the National Governors Association and others who promoted the federalization of standards, I think they have said that high standards raise performance. Thus far, that has not proven to be true.
In Colorado.
In Colorado or any place.
Massachusetts definitely has.
Well,
Florida has. There are states that have been doing it longer that have seen results.
I think I would question that, but that's a debate probably for another time. But that's the premise under which we've been operating. And if there's, you know, getting back to the survey, that those groups that have been most responsible for successfully promoting and having adopted as a matter of public policy these standards are the only ones who believe they are extremely or very effective. Every other group believes that they are either not very effective at all or at best only moderately effective. So, and I can guarantee you out of reading down this list here, about the only group that is going to talk to us and lobby us about this issue is going to be that group that believes that they're effective or extremely effective, very effective or extremely effective. So the question is, how do we receive adequate, and let me get to one other thing. It could be perceived that those who believe they're working are the real experts and all these other people don't know anything, which is attempted to be evidenced by the chart on the next page, which shows, you know, the less training you have, the more likely you are to think standards don't work, which I kind of view that as a pejorative chart. But so the question really becomes, are we going to find a way to effectively evaluate the claims of those who have promoted these specific standards? And if we find that they cannot make a case that these specific kinds of standards have achieved the stated result, then I don't think that any of us are advocating we don't have standards, but perhaps that we have a significant change in these standards, or perhaps we allow more local flexibility in the adoption of standards, which might make a lot of sense to Ignacio if they have a set of standards that they believe serves their community. Perhaps it ought not to be against the law for them to try those standards. And that's a decision we're ultimately going to make here, is when we in 2018 adopt these standards, and there's a lot between here and there, and most of what's between here and there is to receive input that is self-selected and is going to be largely driven by education policy advocates. And so how are we going to evaluate that, and what are we going to do about it?
Rebecca. I just wanted to share that although we all want to see student achievement rising, I think part of what these standards help us do is get a snapshot of where we're having a problem so that we can try to address the issue of equity. I know with our state's budget constraints, it's incredibly difficult once we know where students are struggling consistently to help get the resources into those classrooms to make sure that we can solve the problem. But I think part of the purpose of these standards is to show us where we have the biggest problems, and then solving it with our state's budget constraints is perhaps a somewhat different puzzle piece. One question that I would have is, do we have any data about parent and student familiarity with the standards, or data about how schools are going about educating parents and students about the standards so that they can understand?
So from this survey, we can answer the first question, which is we can break down by familiarity just that particular student group and parent group of respondents. But to your larger question, the role of the state education agency has typically been to serve district leaders and to help them do their work in supporting their parent communities. We work very hard to develop parent resources and so on, but we haven't directly been involved in that type of work, so we don't typically know exactly what's going on there. Yeah, but you are very right that that's important.
So two things. One, we need to respond to your question as to the process going forward. I am wondering if we are getting a little confused between what's a standard and what is curriculum and teaching strategies, et cetera. I don't know whether Ignacio cares any less about whether their kids learn how to add, subtract, and multiply and divide. And that's what the standards address. And as a state, we have said we want all kids to learn how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. Well, there are lots of other things, reading as well, and writing, and speaking, and spelling. but the curriculum and the way you teach them is a local issue. I don't disagree with Dr. Flores, which is that our districts often are very resource poor in terms of getting the kind of curriculum that they want, that is really effective for their kids. But that's not what this is about. There is no way, when people say we can't have Common Core, states that have tried to get away from Common Core have discovered that there isn't anything to get totally away from. There may be some slight differences, and there probably will be some more slight differences in our standards, but it's still going to be about whether our kids learn to add, subtract, and multiply and divide, and whether all kids in the state learn that. We need to kind of try to keep separate, and maybe pretty soon it's time for us to look at those specific standards that you're talking about so that we get a better sense of what that discussion is versus all the different ways that all the different districts address those outcomes that we want. But we do need to go back and give staff some feedback on the process. They have asked us to, can't see that far, for 13 content areas, create review committees, et cetera, et cetera. What do we agree with here? What do we not agree with? Is that where you were trying to get me?
No.
Back to there?
But that was a good place to get anyway.
Do you have another comment?
My only other comment was just a clarification that we haven't brought up a lot, but in the law, I will just say that districts are allowed to actually have their own standards as long as they meet or exceed the state standards. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's just one point.
Douglas County did that, if I'm not mistaken.
The state decides whether they meet or exceed.
Just as a point of clarification, the state is not involved in that. This is an assurance that districts provide the state. Kind of the catch that we have in our system is that our accountability system is based on the performance of schools and districts on our state assessment, which measures the degree to which students are mastering those standards.
Yes, but you had to tell Douglas County whether they're...
No, we weren't involved.
So they can just say, any district can say our standards meet or exceed,
right?
And that's all there is to it.
Right. The state does not. There's no record keeping around that. There's no monitoring of that. That's through an assurance that districts provide the state. Yep.
Madam Chair. Thank you. I think we're now down to the rub, which is tests, which I think the way we select tests, one of the criteria in the bid is that they measure the standards. If I'm not mistaken, that's a bid criteria. So we have tests that are set to the standards that have been adopted, and no district is allowed to deviate and give a different test. And that's the way the standards are enforced. In theory, state law might allow Douglas County to do anything they want, except they have to take the state test. So if they want to perform well, they will teach to that standard, and that drives curriculum. And that then really gets to the heart of the issue, is should these federally imposed standards, and I know Jane's going to tell me the state adopted those standards, but the reality is try and change them without federal approval, and you'll find out whose standards they are. So as long as we have a test that reflects those imposed standards, it will drive a curriculum that is essentially a nationally imposed curriculum, which drives out innovation, drives out creativity, leads to, as I was approached over the weekend when I was working out by a parent, that the school which his daughter attended spent 3 months teaching to the test, and he was not happy about that. So I think if you really want to get to the problem, these are all intertwined, but resetting the standards, and then if we could actually have meaningful standards that are our own standards that are not driven by the National Governors Association or the interest groups that have worked with the National Governors Association to impose these standards, we might be actually able to get back, and if we can especially eliminate and allow some districts the flexibility of coming up with tests that are different, then they can set their own curricula, they can drive the result they want to drive, and that gives us a chance to eventually see what works and what doesn't work.
And I just wanted to add, if you turn to page 14, which is how effective are the Colorado assessments and standards in addressing the needs of students, I think students tell the truth. And if you look at that bar, you see that academically, there's a bar for academically advanced students. Can you project that on the...
Yeah, we can pull that up. No, unfortunately, it's not part of our slide deck.
Oh,
and just
okay.
to clarify on that, these aren't student responses.
Okay.
These are all of the respondents. They were replying to how well they believe that these standards meet the needs of the different student subcategories.
And if you look at it, you have academically advanced students saying that, yes, they're great. These standards are great. 7% of them say they're extremely effective. And when you get to English learners, it's not even 1%. Or students with disability, you know, as far as extremely effective. But yet when you go to the other side, you have academically advanced kids who say, well, they're not effective. That's 16%.
It's not the kids that are responding here. It's not am I correct? The responses.
Oh, I thought these were from.
No. The responses are from the almost 3,000 people.
Well, but they're pretty much telling you the truth as to how, you know, when you go out there, that's that for students with disabilities, 33% said, you know, they're not good at all. Or for 26% of English learners. And I don't know. I think that's kind of telling you about the test. Most of this, I think, is not telling you about the standards. It's telling you about the test.
There is something to that.
When I could find it, but I don't have my good glasses with me. What's the date? When is the end point for the specific input into each and every standard?
So
my teacher head tells me that's where I'm going to learn something about what people are thinking about each standard, which may answer a lot of these questions.
So the online system will be open through February 17th.
Okay.
Again, we can extend that timeline because essentially our intention is to take all of that feedback and give those to the committees. The committees will likely not be meeting until, you know, we're anticipating till over the summer, so we could extend that timeline.
Well, just my own personal offering, I'm looking toward that kind of information to get a little bit better insight. The general questions were, I do think they are and had been constructed and handled the best we can. Surveys are really a nebulous. I don't like them. I never have liked them. I have never liked composing them. I think there's a lot of ground for whoever you're talking to and how they interpret the meaning of a word is interesting. And it's beyond the word standard. It's just the whole idea of asking a broad range of people at the same time that they're a little bit randomly taking part, if nothing else, and to know how effective a standard is. If I don't know, I won't go on you. I think you know what I'm talking about. I just think that specific info is going to be a lot more helpful to me.
Madam Chairman.
Yep.
I do have a couple specific questions and specific suggestions. I'm not sure they're financially practical, but there are, let's take the existing Colorado and Common Core math standards. There are nationally recognized people, one whose name escapes me is a professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, who are highly critical of these standards and promote different standards. I think it's important to find a way to bring a different voice or other voices into these standards, because if we allow the message to, or I mean, what's going to happen, I think is what always happens to this board, is that if nature takes its course a couple of months before we're obligated by law to make a decision, we'll have something put in front of us which is likely to reflect the process, and the process, there's nothing wrong with it, except I believe it yields a very predictable result. So if we're going to have at least options, you're going to have to bring in some of those people who are openly critical and have other ideas, and have an opportunity for this board to consider those other ideas and those other standards. If we're going, and so the suggestion I would make is, I don't think there's any way to necessarily avoid, nor should you avoid, the process you've outlined it here, but it should be augmented with other points of view, and it should be augmented, if possible, and I just happened to price this for another reason, but if memory serves me correct, a single session focus group costs you about $17,000 a session. That may be well beyond our budget.
Yeah.
But I think if there's a way to squeeze it in, if we could actually get one, it would be highly instructional. So, but it, 17,000.
A focus group.
I wish it were 100, but because I'm pricing it for someone. But at any rate, I think that if we're going to have an option to consider anything except that which the experts and the experts that participate regularly want us to have in front of us. Now, if we want to have anything else in front of us, we got to start now, bring in these other points of view, try and evaluate them effectively, and then be in a position to see whether we can come consensus or come by a majority vote to whether or not we agree with the standard that's being presented. Otherwise, we're going to get a set of standards that are going to be remarkably similar to what we have, and we're going to have, under the press of time, no choice but to accept them. And I think every member of this board has been in exactly that position where deadlines are approaching. We now have to make a decision. None of us have the expertise to say, well, I have this 50-page document here that's a better choice. So we get to pick from a very limited menu, if any menu at all, that has been created by the interest groups, then advocated by the staff as a product of those interest groups. Nothing wrong with that. And then we then get to vote yes. And if we're going to avoid that, then you're going to have to bring in a lot of other expertise. You're going to have to bring in differing points of views, even though some people may find that painful. And you're going to have to find a way to see if those points of view receive at least some attention and from this board.
Other responses? Mm.
I'm looking over what we're supposed to evaluate here, and it doesn't sound much like what I see going on here at the board. But I do, and I know we're not voting, but I do agree with Board Member Durham about getting experts in some of these fields. I don't know if we need all of the fields, but some of the ones that have the most questions about the standards. If we have the expertise of even a few people giving their input, I think we'll be much further ahead as a board to vote on something than we are with a survey. But I do appreciate the work you've done, and I don't know if we should stop that. It would be interesting to compare that to what we get from other people. But other states that are using experts in the field, I think, would be on the path that I would like to take, too. So my recommendation would be that we get some input about that other side of the issue at the next board meeting.
Would have we in the past and at the current time considered part of the groups that have been working on this is to be our higher ed and K-12 educators? I guess the question is more for my colleagues. Are they considered experts in your minds? Teachers, instructors, teachers, are they an interest group that's taking part in this survey and contributing for since 2007 when we started this last Colorado Standards work? Are they expert enough or not?
No, I mean teachers.
Teachers,
teachers, both higher ed and K-12. Yeah.
I think I'll take a stab at that. I think some are, some aren't. But the mere fact you respond to a survey doesn't put you in either category, so you don't know whether they're experts or participants.
True.
And I would say...
I agree.
So I would say you evaluate that point of view, but there needs to be available to us other points of view to be evaluated. And I think the answer is I don't think you stop what you're doing. I don't think you have any choice but to do what you're doing. Question is, can you adequately augment it to bring us some additional information?
Very, yes. Very good suggestions, Mr. Durham.
Madam Chair, I'll also just end, so we will take that feedback to heart, absolutely. Just two little points. I would encourage you all to be asking your districts and schools, you know what, because you're a part of the feedback process, too. You represent districts, and so I'd be encouraging you to be checking in with them about how they feel, too, because that will augment your opinions of just these surveys. And then the last piece to Board Member Rankin's request to have this by the next board meeting, that might be challenging because I think our materials are due next week. It's amazing how quick the cycle moves, but I just want you to know we will absolutely take that to heart and get you something soon.
Okay. Okay, moving on to 14.01. Madam Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. The next item on the agenda is actually a request from you all from several months ago wanting to have a little more information about the supports that CDE gives to low-performing districts and schools. So this comes to you as an information item, as a request from you. And so I will turn it over to Alyssa Pearson and Peter Sherman and Nazi. I can't say your last name, Nazi.
Go ahead, Jerry Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I know you all have just been, your brains are full and heavy from that conversation right now. We just want to take a little time. This is, you can sit back and listen. Just give you an overview based on some of the questions and conversations we've had over the past few months about what the supports are that CDE is providing for our low-performing systems, specifically our schools on priority and districts on priority improvement and turnaround. So we're going to give you an overview of what those supports are and share with you some of the preliminary data we're seeing on them. This is initial data. It's kind of a blunt review of it. We have a lot more to learn, but we want to show you what the initial outcomes are starting to look like. And just kind of share with you where we're seeing some successes or some initial success. So thank you for taking the time to listen to this day today. We really appreciate it. I'll turn it over to Peter and Nazi, who will talk through the details.
Thanks, Alyssa. Madam Chair. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking time to work with us today. I'm Peter Sherman. I'm the Executive Director of School and District Performance Unit here at CDE, and my colleague Nazi Moajiri Nelson is the Director of Data, Program Evaluation and Reporting, and as she said, a lot of other things. We're glad to be able to share with you some of the information that we've seen. Over the past few years, CDE has created a number of different support structures that we have created and developed to really try to target supports for low-performing schools and districts. So today we just want to begin the conversation with you, sharing some background information about those supports, but also to share some of the initial impacts that we've seen. As we transition to ESSA, we also see this as a great opportunity to reflect on and to refine and to think about the supports that we offer and hopefully determine what's working really well and to build on that. Our goals for today are, there are three goals, really to provide you with an overview of some of the more intensive support structures that we offer to these low-performing systems, to share some of the initial impacts specifically of the Turnaround Network and of Connect for Success, and to provide some context for future conversations and decisions around these support structures. Specifically, this will come up again in the ESSA conversations. So this slide will provide an overview of some of the major intensive supports that we offer. As I talk down through the slide, just take note that the supports were sort of transitioned from district-level supports to school-level supports to supports for individual people. Eligibility for these supports varies somewhat, but is generally available for districts and schools with priority improvement or turnaround ratings on our state performance accountability system. Each of these supports also include funding. Most of them are with federal funds, some with state funds, and eligibility tends to be around the rating as well as Title I status. So we'll go into more details about most of these supports, but I'll give you a quick overview around what's on this slide. Around district support, we're engaged with about 22 different districts. Some of those districts are on the clock. Some of them have schools that are on the clock. Many of those districts are engaged in multiple supports here. Our goals are really to build upon the district capacity to help them have the ability internally to be able to support the schools that are currently on the clock or perhaps others that may fall onto the clock. So our district supports are ranged from being quite informal to being more formal, such as our Turnaround Learning Academy that was initiated last year. That work with districts also includes some of the work that we're doing with districts around the accountability pathway development. Our turnaround network is probably our most intensive support that's really utilizes a performance management model, which I'll talk about more in a few minutes, where our staff engage with principals and with principal supervisors in the districts to really go through a process, an ongoing process of planning, strategic action planning, and reflecting on what's working or not. The Connect for Success grant is a grant that's in its first year here, and it's a grant that works specifically with schools, with 20 schools this year, and the Connect for Success grant really tries to work with those schools to look toward activities that are identified in our high-achieving schools study, something that's on our website that I believe you've seen. The Tiered Intervention Grant, or the TIG grant, or also known by the School Intervention Grant, or the SIG grant, is a large federal grant that's been in existence since 2010 and requires certain turnaround models and generally tends to have larger grant sizes. That TIG grant is not going to continue under ESSA, but it will. We will run out the funding that we have over the next few years. The School Turnaround Leaders Development Grant we've spoken about a number of times recently. This is our state program that's really designed to build the capacity within Colorado to support leadership, and we all know how important that piece is. And then another grant that's not listed on this is our Pathways Grant. This is a grant that we initiated last year to support districts in planning for the different pathways that they would explore, the schools that are on the clock that may reach the end of the clock as they work toward that process that you all may direct actions if they reach the end of the clock. We're also currently working on a grant that would support districts with the implementation of those pathways as well. So we can produce a handout that gives you more specifically. You've asked which schools and districts are engaged in which of these. We have that information for you. We've broken it down by congressional district as you've asked, so we'll share that with you as well. A couple of dense slides here, so forgive me with all the information. Last month, we heard questions from you about how many schools apply for grants, how many are accepted, what the participation is. This slide illustrates that information for these following supports. The number of eligible schools, the numbers of schools that have applied, number of schools that are acceptance, the acceptance rates, the average award amount per year per school, and the funding source. Eligibility, as I said earlier, generally aligns with school plan types of priority improvement and turnaround, and it also has to do with some federal designations of priority or focus schools, and it may have to do with their title status as well. Schools that are not designated as Title I schools are generally not eligible for the federal funding, but in many cases we are able to invite them in to participate in the support structures themselves. So as you can see, about 75 to 80% of applicants are accepted into the Turnaround Network, the Connect for Success, and the TIG grants. For the Leaders grants, the percentages of acceptance are much lower. That's really a result of us having quite a lot of applications and more limited amount of funding, so we tend to have more demand than the supply there. We've also included in this slide the average amount of the award per school per year. We'll come back to that a little bit later in the presentation. I will pause if there are any questions. Otherwise, I'll keep moving. Yes.
Is it the case that the number of acceptances that we see represent about the capacity for our resources and our ability to help these schools? Or, oh, okay, so that kind of answers a follow-up question I might have, which is, I was wondering if it was the case that if we could get more of these eligible schools to go ahead and apply, could we help more schools? Or are we seeing that these acceptance numbers are representing right about where our resources are in terms of how many we're able to help with these programs?
I think that's a Madam Chair, I think that's a great question, and I think the answer is there's a little bit on both sides of the answer. Certainly, our goal is to sort of have the greatest return on investment of what we do, whether it's money that's distributed, whether it's money that supports our staff, or other ways that we're using the financial and the personnel resources that we have. So. I mean, I would say that our staff are stretched fairly thin, and some of these support structures require less staff time because they're more about granting money out, and districts do most of that work. And there are others, such as the network, that are much more intensive and require more staff time. So I think this is part of our reflection on, as we present this information to you, is reflecting on what is having the most impact given our time and our energy and these dollars that we have available.
May I add, Madam Chair?
Sure.
In the situations where the funds exceed the number of applicants that we receive, especially qualified applicants that meet approval ratings and get the grants, then what we do, we tend to run a second iteration of the application to try to get more applicants and get the word out more and work with applicants in writing their applications so that we do try to use up the funds that are available.
I would just also add that the federal funds that we have are certainly limited, and most of the supports that we're talking about today, these intensive supports, are driven by federal funds. There's very little state funding that supports a lot of this work.
If we have the excess money in those accounts, do we return it? I mean, what happens to that if we don't use it for these programs?
My understanding, and Alyssa, feel free, the federal funding, we certainly strive to use all of those funds, and I think that there are times where those funds can roll over. Typically, we don't have to return it right away. There's usually an expiration date of, I think, around a 3-year period on funds, so we're able to use those funds over time.
If it's a federal fund, can it be used for another program within a federal fund area, or must it stay in that, and we're just trying to find more participants to take advantage of it?
All of the funding sources have different criteria and different parameters, of course. For example, the TIG funds is what we call our 1003G funds. Those are much more constricted and prescribed. The 1003A funds allow us more flexibility than others.
And Mr. Sherman, do you have an idea of how much money we've returned to the federal government because we haven't used all of the grant money that was allocated in any one year? Just an idea of that?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that we have returned any money. I think we are able, because the federal grants tend to have a longer rollover life than the state grants. Usually those have to be used within the year. As Nazi talked about, we've been able to find ways to either get people qualified and ready for the grant or find other grant opportunities. Some of the federal funds are more flexible on the school improvement dollars. The TIG money has been very narrowly focused, but Brad indicated that we haven't returned any money to the federal government.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What does qualified mean? How do you decide qualified?
Qualifications for grants?
Mm-hmm.
Each of these different support structures have different eligibility criteria that are communicated out. Is that am I answering your question?
Well, the reason I'm asking, you said that sometimes you go looking for qualified applicants or try to get them qualified.
Eligible. For eligibility.
Sort of,
sorry.
I guess I'm sort of thinking there that's sort of the same thing, eligible.
Do you have an example that might help? Yes. So, for example, for the Connect for Success grant that we've been talking about, eligibility criteria includes having been Title I for the current year and the prior year, and having had an an SBF rating of priority improvement or turnaround and being on the state clock for in years 1, 2, or 3. And therefore, from those criteria, we identify a list of schools that are eligible for the grant, and there's an RFP process that they have to follow to submit an application that is evaluated, and if the application meets the criteria that's established for the application part, then the schools receive the award.
But you have sometimes found that you have money available for those that those schools are not applying for?
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
You have funds for those turnaround programs that schools are not applying for?
Oh, yes, ma'am. There are times, oftentimes, where schools will be on an eligibility list and they and their district opt not to submit an application, and there are various reasons why they might not feel that that particular grant opportunity might be the right fit for them, or sometimes it's because they haven't heard of the grant opportunity, or they heard of it too late and couldn't put together what they needed to for the application. So by rerunning the application process, we provide them an opportunity to gear up and prepare for applying.
Do you have
time? Madam Chair, I think just to conclude that slide, I mean, it's certainly our goal and our ongoing goal is to think very strategically about those funds that we have, and to think about what's having the most impact, and to think about sort of what are the levers, money and other resources that are helping districts make the changes that they need to make for improvement. So we'll dig into a couple of the different supports now. I'd like to speak a little bit more about the Turnaround Network and give you some background on that. The Turnaround Network was established in 2014 and has steadily increased in our participation. We began the network in our first year with 9 schools in 5 different districts. And this year we have 34 schools We started with 9 schools in 5 districts. We're up to 34 schools in 9 different districts. Those network schools serve over 12,000 students across the state. The network continues to grow each year, and all of the districts that have participated thus far have requested to increase the school participation each year. The network is built on what we call a performance management model, in which CDE staff work really closely side by side with principals and with principal supervisors. They meet every 6 to 8 weeks at the school. They prioritize, they plan, they monitor, they collect information, and they reflect on how things are going in those schools. That's a process that's very unique and individualized to each school. For this reason, this model requires a lot of CDE staff time, and it's more intensive than other supports. This really, I would say, represents our most intensive support. It spans for 3 years. In the beginning of the process, we thought, well, this will be a 1-year process. In the second year, we thought, well, maybe we do 2. We're finding that 3 years is about the sweet spot for the network. The goal of the network really is to catalyze quick and sustaining changes at the school level, but also to work with the district and have them at the table so that we can support their capacity, as I mentioned earlier. Network schools also convene 3 to 5 times a year to engage in professional learning experiences. That's with CDE and with external partners. Topics there include school culture, academic assessments, instruction, human capital, and talent management, and those sorts of things. For example, on February 1st, we're holding an event. We'll have about 80 school and district leaders that will come, and the whole day is all around recruiting and retaining and hiring teachers and leaders for low-performing schools. We expect to exit 9 schools from the network this year, and we believe we have the capacity, to your question earlier, for about 17 more schools in the network. Grants are awarded from about $30,000 to $50,000 per school per year for those 3 years, and these are supported by federal funds. Schools can exit from the network by earning their way off of the accountability clock and demonstrating that they've really shown sustained growth and improvement. As districts exit, we do a diagnostic process where we capture some of the improvements that they have made, and we continue to welcome them to other learning events. We just stop them, keeping them in the network formally. So a couple of data slides to share with you, finally, as what we're seeing as some of the initial impacts of the network. So based on the preliminary school performance frameworks, we have some promising data to share. The left box on this graph pertain to the first cohort of 9 schools, which entered the network in 2014. 7 out of those 9, or 78% of those schools, came off of the accountability clock after 2 years in the network, according to the from the 2013 SPFs to the preliminary 2016 SPFs. Similarly, on the right-hand side, that represents the second cohort of 15 schools, which entered the network in the spring of 2015. 7 out of those 15 schools, or 47%, came off the clock after 1 year working in the network. And then that orange line indicates when network services began for those schools. We're excited about these, and we also recognize that it's complicated. It's not, there's not just a single point of intervention with schools. A couple more data slides. This slide shows a comparison of schools that had priority improvement or turnaround ratings in 2013. Of those that were in the network, 63% have earned the highest rating of performance in 2016. And of those not in the network, 38% of those earned the highest rating of performance in 2016. It's a small n size because this is our first cohort, so it's 9 schools, but we see that that's comparison is a nice thing to be able to have. It's difficult to find a comparable group, and I think as we have more data as the years go on, we'll be able to have more that we can share with you. And then in this slide, we display some TCAP and PARC data in language arts and math data from the years that they were participating in the network. Again, this is from cohort 1 from 9 schools. The red line represents the percentile rank of cohort 1's students on English language arts. The blue line represents that percentile rank in math. There were 9 schools, about 3,200 students in those schools. Most of those schools, 8 out of 9, were elementary schools, so they had some K-2 students. So probably a third of those students were not represented because they were not taking these assessments. So this probably represents 1,500 to 2,000 students. And then, that orange line indicates where the services began, and the green line at the top represents the state average. So whereas these achievement rates are still quite low, we're certainly not where we want to see them, we are certainly seeing a trend in the right direction. And then finally for the network, we certainly want to understand the causality of the improvements that we are seeing. We know that these are products of a lot of different factors. These slides look at some of the common practices of network schools to say what's happening in those schools. We believe that the support that's provided by CDE, that intensive support, along with some external partners that are paired up with schools through the grants, are having an impact. So some of the factors that we know are really having an impact, an active focus on school culture and climate. So really resetting the expectations for students by all the adults in the buildings to have high academic expectations, a sense of shared accountability throughout the building that we're all here for all of these students. Remodeling as necessary learning environments, so creating learning environments that are bright and active and really student-centered, and then creating and increasing those meaningful connections with families. Performance management tools and practices, we believe, really help staff work and to prioritize their resources and really focus on what they need to do. There's increased regular and supportive observation of instruction by principals for teachers, and that's a requirement that we have in our network. And then there's also increased observation by principal supervisors. We strongly suggest that those principal supervisors are in network schools every week, observing and giving feedback to principals. And that's a practice that that often is not in place. The use of relevant data, and then really rethinking recruiting and hiring practices in the schools specific to the needs of the school. So key to the network is that we've exposed schools and district leaders to excellent schools and experts who've approached schooling in different ways. Our network principals have learned quite a bit and I think have created quite a community of learners. On this slide, we've also included some quotes and anecdotes from some of our participants. The Comprehensive Center in West Ed conducted a program review last year, which you've been provided with that information, and that includes survey information that's been taken from participants and some anecdotal feedback as well.
Questions?
Okay. We'll shift to Connect for Success, and Nazi's going to speak to that and to the TIG grants.
The Connect for Success grant is a two-phase model that was began in 13-14. We identified high-achieving schools that had had success with the achievement of their disaggregated groups. We conducted a study within the 14-15 school year of the effective practices that were being implemented by those schools. We focused in on strategies and practices that they were implementing that the school leadership and teachers felt were contributing to their success. We created a grant, which is called the Connect for Success grant, wherein grantees receive an opportunity to network with and learn from and replicate the practices that were implemented by the high-achieving schools. The reports that we've written in regards to our findings from the high-achieving school study are provided through the link on your PowerPoint. If you click on that, that will take you to several reports that we've written in regards to the practices that we saw in those schools. Soaring Eagles is one of the high-achieving schools that the board recognized last month as a Blue Ribbon winner. This is the second time that school's won the Blue Ribbon because of the high performance of their disaggregated groups. They're a high-poverty school that continues to exceed expectations, and the board recognized and honored them last month for the second time as a Blue Ribbon winner. Connect for Success grantees are provided several different opportunities, including starting the grant off with a kickoff meeting where they get they hear a presentation from a panel of school leaders from the high-achieving schools. They get an opportunity to engage with and learn from those principals and school leaders. Then they make a site visit to the school. They hire an implementation coach or a mentor who is an experienced educator that meets specific qualifications, including having implemented Title I programs and having had a history with working with low-performing schools. And then that implementation coach helps them design a replication plan or an implementation plan to replicate the strategies and practices that they've learned by networking with the high-achieving schools and from our study findings. After their site visit, they create that implementation plan. The implementation coach also helps with progress monitoring and reporting to CDE how the implementation is going. We currently have 20 schools in cohort one of the grant who are in their second year of implementation, and we are also running an application to add some new grantees as a second cohort. The first year of the grant, grantees received $20,000. That's their planning year, and they use those funds for paying for networking with and making site visits to the high-achieving schools. Second and third year are full implementation years. A lot of our grantees begin implementing strategies in that first year because what they learn by visiting the high-achieving schools are strategies that can help them and be implemented right away with little or no dollars. So they start those implementation strategies right away, and then the second year take on the larger projects that might require more money. Based on preliminary 2016 SBF results, we've also seen very good trends for the Connect for Success grantees. Just like in Mr. Sherman's slides, the orange line represents where the grantees started implementation of their program. In 2014, all 20 of our schools were identified as being priority improvement or turnaround, and we're on years one, two, or three of the clock. In the 2016 preliminary results, we see that over 55% of our schools have come off of the clock, and we will continue to monitor these schools and look forward to seeing how they do with a couple of more years of implementation and whether they can sustain this performance. We've also looked and dug deeper into the ones that have come off of the clock to see, we've learned that 25% of them are actually rated at the performance level, which is the highest SBF rating that schools can earn. In comparison, schools that were eligible for the grant who did not apply or were not awarded the grant, 17% of those schools also performed at the performance or rate were rated at the performance level. So again, we're going to continue to monitor these schools and watch their performance over the years to see if they can sustain this effect. The tiered intervention grant, as Mr. Sherman mentioned earlier, this is a grant that funding, there will not be new funding for tiered intervention grants under ESSA. Locally in Colorado, we call this grant a tiered intervention grant. Nationally, it's called the school improvement grant. You may have heard referred to it as both. For numerous years now, we've been supporting schools with federal funds under the 10OG funds for receiving TIG or SIG grants. This grant has always been made available to our lowest performing schools, primarily the Title I or Title I eligible schools that are performing in the lowest 5%. Most recently, the criteria has been they've been performing in the lowest 5% or have been Title I or Title I eligible high schools that have had extremely low graduation rates. The primary goal of the grant is to see dramatic and sustained improvements in schools. The grant does require, has some very prescriptive requirements, including that one of four SIG models needs to be implemented, the turnaround, transformation, restart, or closure models. Various nationally identified strategies are implemented by grantees. For example, some of the models require that the principal and some or all of the staff are replaced. Schools have to select a new instructional model. All models require an increased learning time for students, except for the closure model. And a new governance structure has to be put in place as all part of the TIG grant. We have funded approximately 50 schools for 3 to 5 years each over the years. The impact of the grant has varied significantly across grantees. We've had some very successful grantees in Colorado, others that continue to struggle with low performance. That is a trend that holds in national evaluations of SIG grants as well. The grants range between $275,000 to $600,000 for the three models other than closure. Closure models are funded at a much lower rate. And they're funded with federal 1003G funds. And like I mentioned earlier, there will be no new funding under this grant for this type of intervention under ESSA. Any questions?
Okay. All right, we'll roll on. Back to me. The School Turnaround Leaders Development Grant, as most of you know, is a state program that began in, excuse me, in 2014. I'm sorry. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm on the tail end of a cold, so I apologize for my coughing. The goal of the program, as you know, is to develop the capacity of leadership training for our low-performing schools and districts. It does that in two ways, by identifying leadership development providers, of which you all have approved a number of them. We have six to date. Over the years. And then it also grants a lot of funds to districts and schools to send individuals to those identified programs. So to date, 120 individuals from 78 different schools have participated over the past 2 years. Grants range significantly given the different providers that we have, but those are that's a state-funded program. This slide shows which programs districts have selected to participate in over the 2 years. To remind you, districts choose the provider program that they apply for that they think best fits their needs. Am I there? The pie chart describes the percentage of participation in each of the identified programs. More detailed information about who participated in which program is available and can be shared with you. We're tracking participation and their experiences to ensure that each of these provider programs offers a lot of value and helps those leaders be able to affect student improvement with their students. So we're in the process of gathering information from about this program, as we've discussed a couple of times in the past. Despite that, it's definitely proven to be difficult to be able to make the connection from a leadership training program to student achievement. There's quite a lag time. Some of the challenges there are around that lag time in training, especially if some of the folks that are being trained are not necessarily at the helm at schools right away. There are lots of factors, as we know, in school improvement, and the unique context of different schools varies quite a bit. But this slide illustrates what we're looking for in leadership development for low-performing schools and districts. All of the identified programs are expected to teach and lead towards the Colorado Principal Standards, which are identified here. So around strategic leadership, instructional leadership, the idea of really influencing for results with students, developing community and external partnerships, and human resources management. So we're working on ways to develop our evaluation process to be able to connect those dots across from the program providers to the outcomes that we're seeking. Okay. So I'll return to the same slide that we shared with you before. We wanted to revisit this and just focus a little bit on the funds and their sources. There were some questions earlier, perhaps we could dig into it if you have more questions. The return on investment is important to all of us. As you can see in that last column, most of the funding we have for supports comes from federal funds. That means that there are some limitations on use of these funds. Typically, it's around eligibility for the Title I status or other designations. The amounts on this table are averages per school per year. The full costs are not clear in all cases. So these are the funds that are distributed through grants, but there are also costs by our staff and that are involved in being able to support these programs as well. So generally, there's about $10 million a year that's distributed in federal funds through what we call the 1003A and 1003G funds that support all of these programs as well as some others. We want to give you an idea of what some of these costs are. As you can see also, the TIG grant, as Nazi was explaining, is a program that was designed to have very large grants, but you can see in some of the other grants, we believe that we're able to make a fairly significant impact on some schools with much smaller grants, anywhere from $30,000 to $80,000 per year. So we'll talk more on January 26th. We, at one of your special board meetings, our ESSA committee will come and work with you again on that date. But we hope that this information will lay some context, some foundation for that conversation. We have one more slide, but any questions about the funding? Okay. So finally, we are in this to learn about what's working and what's not working, and to really focus on what is. We've drawn out some of our key learnings so far. We know that turnaround is hard work. We all know that. But we do believe and have seen that we can support districts and schools to make some quick gains early in a time frame of months and years in short time periods. We also know that, as I was just saying, strategic use of much smaller grants can really leverage partnerships, can leverage gains, changes that need to happen in schools and districts. Performance management helps to really prioritize some of the strategic decision making. That ongoing trusting relationships between the state, the school, and the districts we have found to be very effective. We can support districts to really think about their systems of support and help them with those pieces. Leadership is paramount, and we know that we have more to learn, but we are drawing from this what we can. So thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate your attention.
Thank you. That's a very optimistic report, if ever we've had one. Comments, questions, folks? Joyce?
Out of the turnaround and priority improvement schools, how many do you have in that category? And over time, how many have you had, and you can just give me an estimate, that haven't been interested in taking your services?
Sure. There are, I'm not sure the current number, but we have about 160, 170 schools that have been in priority improvement or turnaround status. That number has changed, and I think as you see the preliminary frameworks soon, I believe in the next couple of weeks, you'll get to see the exact numbers of that. Mm-hmm. You can see the numbers of folks that have participated in these different activities. So out of that 170 or so, it's a percentage. It's certainly not everybody that's been there. I think as both Nazi and I have said, we've made strong efforts to communicate these grants and encourage folks to come in and be involved in these and participate. I know right now we have several RFPs out. My staff's been actively recruiting. I was on the phone earlier with the district talking about the network and helping them think about which schools might be the right fit for it.
So how many have not accepted your help? In other words, you've gone to them, they are getting close to the end of the clock, and they still refuse, for whatever reason, they do not want to be a part of this.
Sure. So this slide has numbers per grant in each year that have applied versus those that have been accepted. So we can do the math there, and we're happy to articulate that better for you. In terms of other districts that maybe we've spoken with or that have learned about these grants that have just said we're not interested,
that's the number.
We don't necessarily. I mean, we can back that out, but we don't necessarily have records of sort of everyone that we've
discussed.
Can you
give me just an approximation? Are we talking 40%? Are we talking 5%?
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be dodging your question, Ms. Rankin. I would say that in terms of like the turnaround network, I would say that of the districts that we've spoken with and schools that we've spoken with about that, I would say probably 75% have applied, and then we have probably about a 75% acceptance rate.
Thank you.
Sorry to take so long to get your answer.
I guess I have a couple questions. Do you find districts coming forward as they're approaching the clock, or do we have districts that are in turnaround or priority improvement and they immediately care mm-hmm. about turning that around?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. I certainly, my experience is talking to folks out in the field that that everyone cares about their school, and I think when schools dip into turnaround or priority improvement for the first year, I think it certainly catches their attention. Some of them, I think, will say, "Hey, we think there's something under control that we can adjust. We're good for now. We're gonna see how it goes." So I think for some schools, it takes them a year or two into the clock to say, "Well, maybe this is a persistent problem that we need support with." And I think, as Nazi was saying, the Connect for Success, for example, is targeted more towards the beginning of the accountability clock. The network, we tend to have people more in years 2, 3, and 4 on the clock because I think that they may be schools that say, well, it seems like we're in this to stay. On this clock, we want some help, and we're more open to accepting that.
So I ask this partly because I think there have been some discussions about whether 5 years isn't too darn long. Mm-hmm. For us to allow schools and districts to be where they are for kids.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether we have the capacity to respond sooner. I mean, I think by shortening it to 3 years, we would create a greater sense of urgency for school districts. But then do we have the capacity, or where else can we go to get the resources to help those folks turn around sooner?
I think that's a good question, and I think it varies. I mean, we've certainly seen, as you've seen in some of this data, we've seen schools that have made significant changes in 1 and 2 years. But typically those schools that have come off the clock, a number of them are in performance, but some of them are not well into performance. You know, some of them are barely there. And so they do have to sustain those changes. And so I think some ongoing support in that improvement category, performance category, is critical.
So that relates to my second question, which is, how do we sustain?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely this sense of urgency, then there's the building of capacity. How do we maintain that capacity and have those habits mm-hmm. become permanent for those districts?
And my first response to that question is really about the district. However number of schools there are, 180 schools, I don't know that I believe it's the state's role to one-off, you know, or consult with every one of those schools, and no, we don't have the capacity to do that over time. But I think with that goal that I mentioned a number of times today of really helping districts build up their capacity, and I think what we've seen, certainly through the network and through a number of these other grants, is districts thinking differently about saying, hey, you know, this is not just a single school problem, but we might have 8 or 12 schools that are on the accountability clock. How do we restructure things? And that might lead deeply into their human resources practices and saying, our low-performing schools need to get first dibs on teachers, or they need to have an extended timeline for hiring, or they might need support or different tools for recruiting teachers to those schools. Or it may be around the supervision. There are some districts that have, where principal supervisors, you know, have 15 to 18 schools that they supervise. We recommend that they have 4 to 5. And obviously that's not feasible in some districts, but in order to give them the kind of support that they need, the districts may need to rethink that kind of thing. How they distribute resources within districts is critical. Whether or not principals are required to come to professional development, or if they have the leadership and the capacity to make site-based decisions. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer here, but these are all ways that we're trying to push districts to think differently about how they manage on a daily basis. And so our hope and our goal is to build up the capacity for districts so that they may have these schools come off the clock, but if they have others that dip in, we want them to be much more agile and ready to be able to address the needs of those schools.
If I may add, Madam Chair,
sure.
We also incorporate into the application process sustainability plans as a requirement in many of our grants, so that even prior to getting the grant, schools and districts are being requested to put in place a plan for how they're going to sustain any kind of improvements that they achieve as a result of the funds, knowing that the funds have a limited life term.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Pam?
Do you ever turn down applications from schools who want this help?
We do, and we have, yes. I think, on again, to that eligibility or to the acceptance rate that we've listed on some of the slides, there are schools that apply that are not accepted.
Why?
For different reasons, for the different grants, but I can speak to the network in particular. We know that the engagement that I described is pretty intensive and requires a leader that has certain capabilities, and in some cases we've gone to where there are schools that were their leaders are not quite ready for that sort of level of engagement. It could be that the district is not ready to support side by side, and that's a critical element of that. Sometimes, frankly, applications are not written in a way that makes a lot of sense, or that gives us the sense that they've acknowledged that there are challenges that they need to work toward, and so sometimes it's an application question as well. But I think, I don't know if you want to speak to any of the other grants.
Yeah. When we write applications, we do tend to include questions around the readiness and the capacity to implement the grant requirements. Particularly with federal dollars, there are a lot of requirements that schools have to meet in order to benefit from those grant dollars, and the application quality is definitely a factor that's considered. A lot of times it also is a matter of not having enough funds to support all of the applicants. Just like we were talking about earlier, sometimes we get too few applicants. There are definitely a lot of times where we have a pot of money that we can make available to eligible schools, and the number of eligible schools that apply far exceed the amount of dollars that are available. And then we have to prioritize who receives the funds based on the greatest need. And so then we do end up turning down schools that are eligible and have written an acceptable and approvable application, but there's just not enough money to fund everyone.
And I can see here that it shows the number of schools eligible, the number of schools applied, and the number of schools accepted. Can we get more information on that?
Absolutely. What other information would
we might want to know what schools in our districts might have applied and not gotten the help?
Yes, we can do that. And then I think, sorry, to the question earlier around capacity, that's another factor for us as well. Some of our supports requiring staff engagement, and we have certain limitations there, given the staff that we have, the number of staff we have.
Are there any particular grants that you would like to information on, or just all of those same grants?
Probably all. I mean, what I'm getting at is if we have schools that are struggling and they're on the clock and they're in turnaround or priority improvement, I guess I want to make sure that, to Joyce's point, now there may be schools and districts who aren't interested, but if we have schools and districts who are reaching out for help, mm-hmm. I guess I'd like to see a good reason why they're not getting it.
And I'm definitely intrigued by the match. We have long talked about matching schools with similar demographics but different results. It would seem to me that those are opportunities for more long-term relationships, simply because you guys are kind of essentially out of the picture after a while, but those relationships have been established.
Yeah.
So I'd be really curious how as we move forward,
absolutely,
how those work, because I think they're a great idea.
And that is one of the founding principles for the Connect for Success. We oftentimes hear from low-performing schools for examples of schools that have their similar demographics but have had really good success. And by establishing those relationships and those networking opportunities, the hope is that then they will continue mm-hmm. to seek out supports and have the, their own colleagues able to support them in the long run as part of that sustainability plan, as
right.
opposed
even
to
even when they bring in some new people. I mean, you've got also the worry about mobility
yes.
of your staff, teachers and administrators, et cetera. And if you can't bring them along, then we've lost some of that capacity that we've narrowed down.
I think there are elements to that piece. I appreciate the comment. I think there are elements to that piece in probably all of these supports, in ways that we encourage folks to visit, to get to know, to engage with districts and schools that are higher performing as well. I think it's a great point.
That's great. Thank you. This is one of the more positive reports that I can remember. I'm really pleased. Remember, we waited for this for a long time. Val's asked for it ages ago, I believe, a year ago at least. Yep. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, if I may, I'd like to suggest a 10-minute break, at least. We've been sitting. Thinking hard, but sitting. We need to know.
Like a minute is going to be.
See, we did 15 minutes. You were caucusing back there, weren't you? All right. I can't stand that gavel. It always scares me.
Wicks you up.
So we're coming back to order. We would like to have a conversation right now about our legislative priorities. I think we came to the conclusion that there's more work to be done. But to the extent that board members would like to provide some suggestions or input to the couple of versions that we have to look at, I think Val and Joyce and Jane would appreciate the help. Yes, ma'am.
Here's my way in. I really liked Joyce's one-pager. It's my feeling that when it comes to legislative priorities, we want to be as broad as possible so as not to, first of all, we may have different ideas on this board about how to go about the goal that the objective sets out, but we all agree that we like that objective. Otherwise, if we get into the weeds on how to go about that, then it boxes us in, or it may box some of us in and others not. So I like the idea of a broad and not get into the weeds about it.
I just wanted to explain the rewrite that I did of the legislative priorities. I started out by going back to 2005, actually, on board documents and reading all of the legislative priorities from the beginning. And the first thing that I noticed that I have to agree with what Board Member Masenik said. We've got to take a higher level look at the legislative priorities. I think it's easy sometimes to get further into the weeds and micromanage what we're doing, and I don't think that's quite what our job is. I also found every year, every step of the way, first thing they talk about in our legislative priorities is finance. And I know finance is always an issue, but I think we have to change the conversation to students. I think students should always come first. I think we should have students first, and that's where my legislative priorities began. Then I went to parents, citizens, district, finance, and federal. Federal meaning flexibility, because we may at any time change on a dime, and we have to be ready to do that. So flexibility is built in all the way. Those were my main issues, and my bullet points underneath those I think are very high level and general enough, but specific enough to talk about what our job is as far as legislative priorities go. So I really did give it a lot of thought. I rewrote it in a very careful way. I don't know if these are on board docs?
I have not posted them on board docs.
Then I will not go into any more details, because it's just not fair. But that's why I rewrote everything. Then we had one meeting and we did some edits, and now it's kind of gone back to what it was before. So I think I agree with Board Member Goff that earlier when she said we need to take another look at it, maybe rewrite it again, and I would agree with that. But the students first was my first thought of all of this.
Steve, Val, any comments? I didn't. I really meant to include individual ones. I meant to include rural kids, because I think they are in need. I also think that a big issue in trying to get that gap, to fill that gap, is that we really do need to have early childhood education. Not everybody will want to, but I think that we have a large number of economically distressed families where that is the only option. And there's a special program, I guess, a PBS special program this week, and this is the second time I've seen it. It's fairly new, and it's on the merits of early childhood education, and it does speak to every dollar you put in, you know, you'll get back $4 to $7 back, and you know, thinking about young parents and where are they going to take their kids. I mean, if you look at other countries, even Mexico has early childhood education, and this is our neighbor to the south, and so does Canada, but we just don't think.
So are you suggesting that goes under students? Help me out.
Well, I'm just kind of pushing my agenda here on my page, and it should be a kind of a big thing. It should kind of stand alone, but again, It'll take money. There's just no ins and buts about it.
all the research says that if we do want our kids to get ahead, for our poor kids, our needy kids, our rural kids, we need to, you know, spend that money in that area.
Just not something we have much control over, unfortunately.
Well,
Steve, did you have some?
That's why we don't have control over it, but because we are policy people and we know that it's important, we need to get it in, and it needs to be big.
Steve, did you have any input that you wanted to provide? Well, you don't have to. No, you don't have to. It's just,
well, just perhaps an observation that we do have to separate our long-term broad objectives from how we'll react specifically to introduce legislation and what kind of legislation we'll ask to have introduced. And I think those are two separate things. And so, I mean, we've had some basic things in the past we've looked at, like local control, things like that we probably ought to emphasize in the long-term legislative priorities, but there won't be a lot of specificity because they won't be associated with specific legislation unless we include something we want this year if we decide to, and that's almost an addendum. Your legislative priorities, for the most part, ought to outlive a single session.
And you don't early childhood well. Quality early childhood.
Jane?
I don't really have a lot more to add other than what I said this morning. As far as rationale, what I tried to do real briefly is I took the other two people's basic comments and I tried to meld them together. Some of Joyce's, for example, there's more than one thought that's in a part, and that's how I reacted as well. I think,
and I liked it, Jane.
I think in the context financially that the state is in, and really we all are, it's a different kind of year in that there just is no extra bucks, piles of buckets of money flying around out there. So how we present things, it is a choice between what's realistic, what's still important, what's broad enough that it can outlive 1 year time and make good decisions. At the same time, I think, you know, yes, I do hope, and I think that our main thrust is what's for the best interests of kids, and how do our parent communities and districts, what's everybody's role and contributions. I liked every single concept presented under Joyce's version of that. I just found it hard to identify if we do have a bill that comes up. You know, on the one hand it matters, on the other hand it really doesn't matter. So it's like, you know, you're not going to lose. It's really a pretty good win-win situation all the way around. I just kind of tended to go toward the specific categories because maybe I'm presumptive. Trying to think like a legislator does, where they would go to a certain. I know. Go to a certain place. Ouch. And find it. What? So I don't think that this is a big battle worth getting into too much. I just think we can come to some sort of a format that is comfortable and we think is going to serve our purpose and is still going to communicate to legislators that may or may not have time, energy, motivation, time to really delve into what we send over there. But we do want to have them pay attention. It's just, you know, it's one of those you don't know what's going to happen to it. And I appreciate that we're not actually voting on some final product today because I don't know that it's necessary. I don't think we have the same, we don't have a real sense of urgency. Everybody's a little bit in limbo land right now, and until and unless we get some specific bills to work with, I think we can slow down just a tad and do good work with that simultaneously. That's kind of where I am right now. So.
Rebecca, do you have any comments?
I just thought of a category, but this might be adding more, and that would be
And that would be the gap.
Well, it's in
the
here.
The achievement gap.
Yeah.
And
it's in there already.
And that, you know, that should be priority, and early childhood should be under there. And
so could we ask you guys to table it for today, ask you guys to spend some thoughts and time on it, and maybe have Jennifer at least provide some feedback or some help, since you're over there pretending like every one of the legislators
the
is actually going to read it.
Answers are with us. Plus, there is one question we had for our attorney as far as if there's anything in there specifically about the waiver language. So if we're not done. We're not ready to do anything right now.
Okay. So we'll table that for next time, please. Okay.
Do you need a formal motion? Or
Nope. I don't think so. Do you need a formal motion to table? Table's table?
Yeah.
Yeah, table's table.
We're okay.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, guys. So I guess we'll go down the line. What I did on my Christmas vacation, Steve. I meant board reports. I would just.
Oh, board reports.
Thank you.
Well, see, I think the one thing I learned is I still have the cutest 3-year-old granddaughter around, so that was my Christmas vacation. On the business side, the only thing I had planned was last week I was supposed to visit Edison 54J School District, which was the top performing school district in the state located in El Paso County. It did snow that day, so that got canceled and is now rescheduled for February 1st.
Okay. You can give us a report next month. Dr. Flores.
I have been kind of listening to Gilpin Montessori people, the community, and in fact I visited Gilpin yesterday, where parents and board got together and discussed it really in a big way as to measures that were into it. And I did say that we cannot get involved. We cannot get involved.
Thank God we can't get
involved in their matters. But, you know, Gilpin is an old school. I remember I was telling Steve that I worked on that DAC, the district group, the SEAC, School Improvement and Accountability Council. And I remembered and went back to 2012 when SEAC made the recommendation that we like the expeditionary learning school, but maybe they shouldn't have placed it, you know, where they did, because that was going to take kids away from the neighboring schools that were one of them, which was Gilpin. And so, I mean, that has happened. And so I'm sorry, and I'm hoping that the Denver board, they're away from one point. In fact, they probably do have that point. Alyssa, do they have, was Gilpin one of the schools where the mistake was made?
You know, Madam Chair, we went back and looked and talked to the district. There was no conversation that we could find about any concern about calculations from the state data with that school. So
right.
There is nothing we have record on there.
Right.
So,
and well, it's one point, and I think they reduced it from 2 points to 1 point, which made a big difference because that would have got them into, you know, really up there where they were hoping. And they still have, I think, a couple of years, they felt. But now Denver Public Schools wants to turn that into an office for administrators. So it just doesn't seem fair where an older school with a community that's set and a focus area is the school, the central community. And so, I mean, we can look forward to...
I totally empathize. I've served on a board and had to go through that process twice. It is very painful.
is very hard. The one lesson I learned ultimately is that the kids were just fine. It was very hard on the adults, but the kids
ended up
being fine.
That's not what the research says, but...
So, well, it depends. High school is a little bit different. Anyway, Pam, are you ready?
I really don't have anything, but I have the cutest... 11-month-old grandson.
We can start.
And I survived my first overnight with him very well.
Oh, we need a big picture.
He slept 11 hours. Oh, I didn't sleep. I woke up every hour to look at the monitor.
Rebecca, you get a pass if you wish.
Oh, that's all right. So I spent my holiday break enjoying our college student's first break home from the University of Alabama, and it was wonderful to have her home for a little over a month. Just delightful. And so I spent that time kind of recovering from the 14-month election process. But during those 14 months, I had a chance to meet with a lot of school board members, superintendents, teachers, parents, and students. I toured Aurora Central with Superintendent Rico Munn, and also met with community members at in Northeast Aurora at Fletcher Elementary School. And that same group has asked to meet with me again, and I certainly will. And I met with school board members and stakeholders, parents, and students across the 6th Congressional District from Douglas County up into Adams County and across Arapahoe, and of course in my own home district where my children have gone to school, where my son still is in school at Cherry Creek, and so I've had interactions with stakeholders there as well as board members from Littleton School Board. So kind of a cross-section across the district, and looking forward to more meetings and diving in, and thank you to everyone who has helped me to kind of begin to get up to speed as a new board member, and especially to Alyssa Pearson, who met with me recently for a briefing. Thanks for your patience with all my questions that I peppered you with. And thank you for Dr. Anthus for meeting with me as well and helping me kind of get up to speed. I really appreciate the staff time and patience and effort to help answer all my questions and help me be effective. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
You know, it hasn't been that long since we met, but it seems like, and the holiday break, you know, I had my three great nieces and a nephew ages. You guys are one generation.
We're going to get there.
Oh, I have some of those, too.
Yeah, and they're all 4 years old and under, so that was exciting, youthening, enlightening. And it was very fun in the mountains in Steamboat Springs, so the western slope was easier to get to than it is today, apparently. I have been spending the bulk of my fall months when I can with various kinds of groups in Adams County, particularly, of course, follow JEFCO as well. Adams 14 has instituted a new parent forum, so they gather on a regular basis and they get some topics presented much like a workshop session where they sit down and they discuss this last one was really on how accountability works. It was sort of not the beginning but a follow-up session about the fine points of accountability, and they're working through understanding more and better and trying to keep up with new things that go on. That's basically it. Jefferson County they had a different schedule of break, so they were out until just this past Monday. They were on a holiday break, so things are a little bit differently. So not a lot of activity there, but enjoyed it.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I met with Steve Turner, the Denver History Museum director, in December, and I heard about interesting things happening there and upcoming exhibits. And there was a dialogue about linking the History Museum and the small museums out in our rural areas to educational opportunities. Going to a museum is like a field trip, but if there's some continuity between the small district museums, and we do have some very interesting ones in the western part of Colorado, maybe linked with what they're doing here at the Denver History Museum in an educational way. we had kind of a light conversation about that until I heard that they have someone in Pueblo at their museum actually writing some curriculum that will be used in the classroom. So when the students go to the museum, it's not just a field trip, but it's an educational experience. And they've also been able to get some funding for some buses in order to take the kids to the museum. So I thought that was pretty exciting. I also spoke with him about maybe working with Gene Hayner here in our library area. He's the director of libraries in the state. And Gene and I had a conversation, Mr. Hayner and I had a conversation about the possible follow-up linkage between libraries, schools, and history museums. So getting that dialogue going and the conversation I thought was really interesting, and I believe Mr. Hayner will be meeting soon, if he hasn't already, with Mr. Turner. Then I had an interesting telephone conference with Peter Sherman and Brenda Bausch here from CDE. It was on December 27th, so that's how dedicated our staff is here. It has to do with the question I asked at the last board meeting, the culture of performance. That's a phrase that I had no idea what it was. And I understand what changing culture is in a business setting. It's not only difficult, but in order to be successful, many factors have to be working together. And in the business world, usually people that work in the business, after they understand what this culture change is going to entail, they have the opportunity to leave. And many of them do, in order for culture change to take place. And it takes years sometimes to change a culture. I had a difficult time understanding how that fits in with our school district. Can teachers and students opt out away from dramatic culture change? And that's where our discussion began. It was very interesting. There was follow-up with some reading materials that were very, very helpful. And I really appreciate Peter and Brenda for reaching out and helping me with this understanding. December board meeting, we also talked about rewriting the priorities, and Dr. Flores and I met, and board member Goff was with us, and we did discuss this as we talked. Yesterday, I went to the SMART Act hearing. CDE did an outstanding job, actually, of describing it to the legislature, the education committees, and I'm not just saying that. I've had a couple legislators come up and mention that too, so that was nice. And one more thing I'd like to share. I talk a lot about shining a spotlight on successful districts and successful schools. And one in particular in my district, SD School District 51, Mesa County Valley, is one of those that has an interesting program on competency-based education. And under the incredible leadership of Superintendent Steve Schultz, he is totally changing what is going on in that district. And he has brought in parents. Everyone is bought into this competency-based education. If you don't understand what that is, you can go to the website. The CDE website. And it's a system where a student is evaluated based on his or her ability to master individual skills or body of knowledge, and they do not move on until that particular skill or body of knowledge is accomplished. And there's a 2-minute, very short video that I would like to share with you that is on the CDE website that shines that spotlight on CD 51.
I think education in the United States is at a very important turning point, and we have to be bold in attempts to do something different.
They've made me who I am today. They've made me more successful than anybody else has.
Moving to performance-based learning, also known as competency-based education, is really a cultural shift.
And that's been extremely powerful for all of our learners.
Because of that engagement, they know where they are and what they need to learn next. In competency-based education, students have to demonstrate mastery of incremental learning units before they are allowed to move on. And so, over time, we won't have traditional grade levels. Students will move at their own pace based on their level of mastery.
You're learning
really matter, like what kind of effects humans have on the Colorado National Monument, for example. We're just doing things that are super interactive and super fun for everything.
Turn them up on the side of the face like this.
So we're really interested in preparing our kids for the kind of world they're going to have to enter as they leave high school and go on to college or whatever post-secondary education they choose.
They taught me things that I had never even thought of.
We really want students to understand a growth mindset and that they can learn anything they want to if they put their mind to it.
I like to actually see what it relates to and how I can use it in my real life.
I'm passionate about this because I believe that this really is a model that will truly match the needs that the students must have in order to compete in the global economy. As we continue on this journey, that people are going to look back and recognize how this was really a turning point. And they'll celebrate the fact that this was a turning point in the community, economically, as well as educationally.
I just want to congratulate Steve Schultz in School District 51, Mesa County.
Thank you. So I just want to make sure that we're all aware of some of the stuff that's coming up very soon. Next week, we have a hub meeting on January 19th. I know a number of you have been either attending or listening in. The 26th, we have another board meeting. February 1st through 3rd is the case conference coming up. And on February 2nd, the NASB is having a regional meeting in Denver, which I believe is mostly around ESSA issues. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. On a personal level, I can't say that I've visited any schools. I spent time with my family. Yes, we had little people. They make the holidays delightful if you're lucky enough to be around them. I am going to be meeting, I think, next week with another one of my school districts, the school board and the legislators. That'll be the third or fourth that I have. And I encourage you that if you represent a district that has that policy of bringing everybody together to talk about the legislative session, to talk about what does the school board want to see, and to have the board members listen to the proposed legislation and provide feedback. And so it turns out to be a very rich conversation. And at the same time, particularly when we've got, when I've had the opportunity to be there, it seems like there's always a question that they have, really no understand that there's just information that they don't have that is very, very helpful. So to the extent that you might have that opportunity, I really appreciate it. And as I said, I have a number of districts that do that. Plus, I get to know the legislators a little bit better that represent them. So thank you. Do we have any speakers?
Let's go check that out.
I think that's our next. Yes, public comment. They're meeting on the 19th.
Okay.
Is that Thursday or Wednesday?
January 19th is Thursday.
Yes, it's Thursday and it's from noon to 4.
What's on the 19th?
No. A hub?
I thought it was from 10 to.
Yeah.
From 10 to 2?
I have it from 10 to 2.
Uh-oh.
I hope that's the case, because that afternoon won't work.
1 second. I'll be able to.
Let me see what I can
write.
Calendar.
Yes.
And I came late because I thought it was.
I have noon also. So we had best get that one straightened out. Find out exactly when it is.
I have the answer somewhere in my email, but now I'm.
It was announced from 10 to 2 with all those people. So, I mean,
I don't know, Val, but we'll work on it. And,
yeah.
And Busy, please be sure to send us all an email since we have two different times.
Okay, I will.
All right, I'd like to welcome back Mr. Walker. We've missed your input. Despite the fact that you wrote down a whole bunch of stuff here, I have a hunch you want to say it rather than just have me read it.
Record, it has more gravitas.
Yeah, I don't think so. Please come forward. Talk to us. You have 3 minutes. And we like your tie.
I'm back, hopefully. And last night, President Obama said to all of us, don't give up, keep trying, you don't always win. And I'm not a good loser. Anyhow, with Mr. Board Member Durham's permission, I'd like to pick on him for a little bit. Is that okay, Steve?
That's fine.
Okay. I halfway agree what you said about experts. And I, for one, wonder, with all the talk about false news and all of our pundits and editorial pages and National Public Radio, Colorado Public Radio, Hillary Rodham Clinton was supposed to win. She didn't win. Did our experts misinform us? Regarding the report, and you're talking about the experts, who are the experts? If you're in the military, the expert is the general. If you're in a medical institution, the expert is the MD. If you're in sports, it's the coach. If you're in law, it's the lawyer. But if you're an educator in our schools of education and you're looking for CEOs, what is a doctorate in education or PhD worth? And sometimes it makes you wonder. I mean, we've all taught, everybody teaches, everybody evaluates. I'm evaluating you and you're evaluating me. But what do the tests say? When I was in med school, the University of Minnesota, Paul Meehl, president of the American Psychological Association, said, IQ is what the IQ test measures. Your operation definition of curriculum and standards is what the standardized tests tell us. But what does a person of color think when we listen to Colorado Public Radio for the last month talking about we're down 1,500 teachers in this state? There's been a significant loss of teachers in the last 10 years, I think 20%. What do teachers think, Board Member Durham, when you question the expertise of the staff here and the teachers? What do they think? What do people of color think when they hear that you're going to have a new standardized test in June, when every test, no matter what you call it, for at least the last 20 years, people of color score significantly lower than Anglos? Mixed race people are in between. What do people of color think? And how much do they trust the experts when all of a sudden, now we're going to come out with a new test in June? Is the results going to be any different? Are Anglos going to score significantly lower than people of color in June? I don't think so. I mean, we're cynical. We have some privileges. What do people who depend upon the experts really think? I don't know of any doctor who's been out in the field who think they're gods. Some of medical school do. But part of being an expert knows you're not a god, you're wrong. And that goes with teachers in education. And they have to be given the respect. And in Colorado, when we're last per capita funding of higher education, 40th in the United States about funding K through 12, 7th of the nation per cap income, and we look at the salaries of CEOs, billionaires, the Broncos, and other. How do teachers feel when their expertise is questioned like you did, sir? And I agree with half of what you're saying. Like, who are the experts?
George.
Who do we look to?
Thank you.
The editorial pages and the journalists on the next presidential election? I don't think so. Thank you for your time.
Thank
you. Thanks, Steve, for taking it. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
We're not adjourned. What's the right word? Keep forgetting. We're recessed. We're recessed until tomorrow. I should remember that word. That was my favorite subject. That was my first.
Madam Chair.
9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
The ESSA hub meeting on the 19th is from noon to 4, and the ESSA hub meeting on February 6th is from 10 to 2.
Okay.
So the
Do
new
you have
one,
that, Val? Steve?
The one next week is from noon to 4.
It's from noon to 4.
It's Thursday.
Yes.
Not good. Elizabeth, can I ask you a question? Can you help me here? All right. Which one of these do I want to
do? You want to do the hot spot.
It should remember. It says I'm not. So it should remember.
Yeah. It should. If you're gone for a few days, it'll pop back up and it'll ask you to retype your password.
I love you.
It's always silver.
Okay, you'll great.
Well, by the way, I remember my slave back in Alabama.
Shoot. Okay. Well, when they go to change it, when they
go home. Granddad
mentioned my slave.
Should be all right. All right, we'll try that. Good. Anything else I need to know?
So I've got a bias against Alabama.
So,
we all have our biases.
Next Wednesday, really. I wanted to suggest
Clemson being the last minute item.
And this is your
It's just we all have.
So this is the problem is this is not.